welcome you into this community of growth and transformation. Here we accept one another and provide opportunities and encouragement towards spiritual growth. Here we give you the space to change, wonder, and explore. Here we encourage a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. Here we may follow different paths, think differently from one another, and we support, listen, and bolster one another. We are Unitarian Universalists. I offer my welcome to you, and in particular to those who are first-time visitors. We invite you to fill out one of the visitor's cards found in the back of your gray hymnal and place it in the offering plate or give it to an usher. We'll send you a church newsletter for the next 3 months to let you know about the programs and activities going on here at church. We are glad you are here and hope to see you again on future Sundays. We have a nursery for infants and young children under the age of 4. It is through these doors and to the left in the first room past the foyer. At the front of the church, we have the spirit chair, which includes activities for all ages. You're invited to go to the spirit chair at any time during the service and take an activity back to your seat. Children and youth are encouraged to attend religious education programs and will be dismissed later in the service by singing and blessing them to their classes. Now for announcements. This is from Robin. The fourth Saturday lunch was a success, thanks to all who volunteered or donated. The Robins, the three Robins, Mike, Lucy, Mike and Sandy, Sabrina, Larry, Cynthia, Marcia, Wayne, Ron, and Pat. And the next one was from Robin Crane. Michael Westlake had a lengthy seizure this week that left him with a concussion and a hurt back. And he regretted that he was unable to attend fourth Saturday lunch. The next announcement is from Nancy Kniff, who's not here, and she's on the Ministerial Search Committee. So this is a quote from her. News from your Ministerial Search Committee. We're very happy to announce that we have received the names of 3 prospective ministers. There may be even additional names since ministers are able to submit their applications until Friday, April 29th. There's a great deal of information on each person that the MSC will read, about 12 pages per candidate. We will start the process of discussing their qualifications amongst the committee this week. This will be followed by teleconference interviews, then a pre-candidating weekend with anyone we think might be a good fit for our special place. Hopefully, we will have someone eligible for a candidating week, and we'll keep you appraised when this happens. Please remember that we absolutely must maintain the confidentiality of these people and are unable to provide any details at this time. But we have 3 candidates, so that's a good start. Let our service begin with a prelude. It's Feeling Good by Nina Simone.
Birds flying high, you know how I feel. Sun in the sky, you know how I feel. Breeze drifting on by, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me, yeah. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me. Ooh, 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 ooh. And I'm feeling good. feeling good. Dragonfly out in the sun, you know what I mean, don't you know? Butterflies all having fun, you know what I mean. Sleep in peace when day is done, that's what I mean. And this old world is a new world and a bold world for me, yeah. Stars, when you shine, you know how I feel. Scent of the pine,
our call to worship. It may be hard for an egg to turn into a bird. It would be a jolly sight harder for it to learn to fly while remaining an egg. We are like eggs at present, and you cannot go on indefinitely being just an ordinary, decent egg. We must be hatched or go bad, by C.S. Lewis. As Alex Reihold lights our chalice, join me in repeating our chalice blessing. We light this chalice, symbol of Unitarian Universalism. May it remind us of the divine spark in all of creation, the power of love to heal what is broken, and to be grateful for life's blessing each day. Our opening hymn is Blessed Spirit of Our Life. It's in a video. It's going to be a little different. The words are actually, it's going to be highlighted. So just follow along. As you stand, as your bodies, are you able? And there's some words that we don't have to do yet. It's also number 86 if you'd rather look at the hymnal.
Yeah.
Please be seated. Okay, our reading now is from Naomi Hashish Nye, a poet, and the poem is called Trying to Name What Doesn't Change. And in case you hadn't figured it out, the theme today is transformation, right? Okay, so trying to name what doesn't change. Roselva says the only thing that doesn't change is train tracks. She's sure of it. The train changes, or the weeds that grow up spidery by the side, but not the tracks. I've watched one for 3 years, she says, and it doesn't curve, doesn't break, doesn't grow. Peter isn't sure. He saw an abandoned track near Sabinas, Mexico, and says a track without a train is a changed track. The metal wasn't shiny anymore. The wood had split, and some of the ties were gone. Every Tuesday on Morales Street, butchers crack the necks of 100 hens. The widow in the tilted house spices her soup with cinnamon. Ask her what doesn't change. Stars explode. The rose curls up as if there is a fire in the petals. The cat who knew me is buried under the bush. The train whistle still wails its ancient sound, but when it goes away, shrinking back from the walls of the brain, it takes something different with it every time.
Each week, we take some time to collect from this community financial resources to support the work of this congregation. We give to this offering as we are able because we know that we are the church. We make the programs and opportunities here. We are the ones we have been waiting for. You are encouraged to give generously to support this congregation in shaping a church of worth and meaning. This week's offering will be greatly received. May it be lovingly given. Come on, I don't know what. It's a fun video.
When a file is buffering, that's a good time to practice patience.
Everything else will work.
While he's doing that, join me in the offering blessing.
to the work of the church,
which
is weaving a tapestry of love we call community. We dedicate ourselves and these our offerings. Can you just... Can you just go back to the presentation? Are you trying?
I'm trying.
Okay. Well, since we're having technical difficulties, we're having our story right now. And I did have them up on the slides. Hang on.
This is a reminder to appreciate it all the more.
Yes.
That's true.
Well, if the kids want to come up front, then maybe I can show pictures as I read. The story today is the Ugly Duckling. It was a warm summer's day. It was a warm summer's day. Mommy Duck wriggled excitedly on her nest. She could hear a tapping noise. Tap, tap, tap. Quick, quack, quick, Mommy Duck called to her other ducks. My eggs are coming. Hatching, come and see. So here's a picture of Mama Duck. One by one, the eggs hatched. And out popped six little yellow ducklings. Ah, the other duck sighed, what sweet little ducklings. Mama Duck beamed with pride. But the biggest egg of all still hadn't opened. Mommy Duck was sure she had only laid six eggs. So here's the pictures of the hatching and the eggs. Just then, the final egg burst open. Crack! Oh, gasped Mommy Duck. The last duckling wasn't little or yellow. What an ugly duckling, quacked the old duck. He's not ugly, said Mama Duck protectively. He's special. And here's this page here is the little gray duck who doesn't look anything like the little yellow duck. The next day, Mommy Duck took all her little ducks to the farmyard to meet the other animals. The six yellow ducklings proudly puffed up their pretty feathers. Ah, sighed the animals, what lovely ducklings. The ugly duckling waddled forward. Hello, he said quietly. Everyone turned and stared at him. He's so gray. Neighed a horse. He's so big, squawked the hen. And here's all the little ducks. And then there's a cow, that's right. And here is the ugly duckling right here. He looks totally different from the other ducks. Nobody wants me, the poor little duckling whispered. He waddled sadly across the meadow, leaving the farm and his family far behind me. So here, he's leaving. He's leaving his family because he thinks he's not wanted, because he's so different. He doesn't think he fits in. Soon the ugly duckling came to a river where some geese were diving for food. "Excuse me," the ugly duckling began bravely, "have you seen any ducklings like me?" "No, you're the strangest duckling we've ever seen," the geese honked. The ugly duckling waddled quickly away. He kept going until he came to a large lake. "If nobody wants me, I'll just hide here forever," he sniffed sadly. "Ribbit," croaked a frog. "What a funny looking duckling." So here's the little duckling and a frog. He's hiding in the reeds. Fall came and the leaves turned gold. One evening, just as the sun was setting, the ugly duckling saw a flock of beautiful white birds gracefully flying across the sky. "I wish I looked like them," he sighed. All through the long winter, the ugly duckling hid in the reeds, ashamed to show his face. When the first rays of warm spring sunshine arrived, the ugly duckling peered out of his hiding place. A graceful swan paddled by him, and he backed away, afraid he wouldn't be teased. So here are the geese, or the swans flying, and here he meets up with another swan. But he doesn't. All right. But the ugly duckling's surprise, the swan swam up to him. "Why are you hiding here?" asked the swan kindly. "Join the rest of us." The ugly duckling was shocked. Surely the swan must be talking to someone else. But then he caught a sight of his reflection in the lake. He stared and gasped in amazement. His gray feathers were now white. "I'm a swan!" the ugly duckling cried happily. "I'm not a duckling at all." Just then, a family of six young ducks waddled along the riverbank with their mother. "Look at the beautiful swan," they quacked. Mommy duck, recognizing her ugly duckling at once. "I always knew he was special," she quacked. The ugly duckling ruffled his beautiful white feathers and turned proudly and paddled away. The end. And now let us sing our children to their classrooms. Rejoice in love we know and share, in love and beauty everywhere. Rejoice in truth that makes us free, and in the good that yet shall be. There it goes. Each week we take time to recognize the joys and sorrows, the celebration struggles of this community. We do this by taking a stone or stones from the bowls as we enter, or from the bowl here on the chancel. We allow the stones to bring us into awareness of those things most important in our life through thought or meditation. We then place them in the cleansing waters of this community, which includes a little bit of water from our annual water communion. If you have joys, sorrows, celebrations, or struggles you wish to recognize, you are invited to come forward now in a ritual of joy and sorrow. Now let us take a few minutes for our own silent meditation, each in our own way.
Sunday we would go to church, pay attention to the priest, he would read the holy word, and consecrate the holy bread, and everyone would kneel and bow. Today the only difference is, everything is holy now, everything, everything, everything is holy now. Moses split the sea in two, and Jesus made the water wine. And I remember feeling sad, miracles don't happen still. Now I can't keep track, 'cause everything's a miracle. Everything, everything, everything's a miracle. Holy now. testament. That'd be very hard to say. See another new morning come. Say it's not a sacrament. I tell you that it can't be done. This morning outside I stood. I saw a little red-winged bird shining like a burning bush and singing like a scripture verse. It made me want to bow my head. I remember when church let out, how things have changed since then. Everything is holy now. It used to be a world half there, heaven's second-rate hand-me-down, but I walk it with a reverent air, 'cause everything is whole now.
A reading by Jiddu Krishnamurti. You know, if we understand one question rightly, all the answers are answered. But we don't know how to ask the right question. To ask the right question demands a great deal of intelligence and sensitivity. Here's a question, a fundamental question. Is life a torture? It is, as it is. A man has lived in this torture centuries upon centuries, from ancient history to the present day, in agony, in despair, in sorrow, and he doesn't find a way out of it. There he invents gods, churches, all the rituals, and all that nonsense, or he escapes in different ways. What are we trying to do during all this discussion and talks here, is to see if we cannot radically bring out a transformation of the mind, not to accept things as they are, nor revolt against them. Revolt with everything you have to find a way out of living differently. That depends on you and not on someone else, because in this, there is no teacher, no pupil. There is no leader, there is no guru, there is no master, no savior. You yourself are the teacher and the pupil. You are the master, you are the guru, you are the leader, you are everything. And to understand is to transform what is. I think that will be enough, won't it?
All right, so my name is Allison Reiheld, and some of you know me already. The listing in church this week said today's sermon was going to be about atheism and transformation. That was an old idea. The new idea, because it has transformed, is that I'm going to talk about the peril and promise of transformation. So a lot of the songs we had earlier were sort of, you know, uplifting views of transformation. Nina Simone's Feeling Good, right? It's a new dawn, it's a new day, I'm feeling good. That doesn't always happen. So I'm going to talk about some of the downsides of transformation as well and sort of how we can think through this. Now, I'm going to see if I can keep this on time. All right. So in our culture, we have a lot of classic narratives of becoming that are not only about redemption, but also about corruption and brokenness. So think of Kafka's short story, Metamorphosis, in the first line of which is, Gregor Samsa awoke one morning to find himself transformed in his bed into an enormous insect, right? The poet Rumi, however, does give this more uplifting version, saying that sorrow clears the way for joy. It waters the fruit, or the trees that have the fruit, which is joy. Parenting is a transformation that a lot of us have gone through. Not all of us have, not all of us should. You don't have to have a good life, but it is a transformation, becoming a parent. And dominant cultural narratives about this paint it as the most wonderful thing, right? A radical change in identity for the better. So wonderful is it supposed to be? So suffused with the golden glow of maternal love are we supposed to be when we become mothers or, you know, fathers with this nurturing, protective sense, right? That those who do not feel this, or who come to resent their children, or even those who have priorities in addition to their children, are all too likely to be condemned. We do not even wish to hear counter-narratives about this particular transformation. Indeed, when women we admire remain child-free, we are all too likely to let slip, but you would have made such a good mother. Or, I wish people like you would have children. We attempt to persuade others to undertake this transformation, which is an enormous transformation. Think also of prison narratives and the film The Shawshank Redemption from a few decades ago, right? Often there are tales of prison as a redemptive experience which strips away all that is not the real you and allows you to finally find yourself and reform, right? And yet prison is a life where you are surrounded by people who struggle, where you are in close contact with them, and with few outlets for your own actual expressions. It's often deliberately a place of dehumanization. And for all that Martin Luther King could write his letter from a Birmingham jail, or Nelson Mandela could remain committed to political liberty while he was imprisoned on Robben Island, the transformations of prison are often not redemptive at all. They make it harder sometimes to be a person who is different than you were. And even if they are redemptive, upon release, ex-convicts are rarely allowed by our society to start over. That's why there's this Ban the Box campaign. If you haven't heard of it, you might look it up. It's an attempt to make sure that job applications no longer have a box to check where you've been convicted of or arrested for a felony, so that at least you can make a first impression that doesn't include that. So transformation actually is neutral, despite the way that we often have the image of the butterfly, right? You're in your chrysalis, you become something else, you're the ugly duckling, and it turns out you were a swan all along, right? But transformation is actually neutral. It has both peril and promise. The real issue is, what do we become? Is that person one with a life in which human flourishing is still possible? Does it matter whether transformation is thrust upon us or chosen? Is the nature of the transformation even within our power to know or anticipate? The narratives I've given already suggest that we already have a cultural sense that the answers to these questions are ambiguous at best. I'm not going to give you clear answers. I'm going to give you more questions. There's a famous essay by a guy named Bertrand Russell in which he says, what is philosophy? It's asking more questions. Doctors don't like bioethicists, which is my main thing, because we come in and we make things that seem black and white, gray, and they're like, just stop. It was really clear before you came into the room, right? So I'm gonna make things very confusing, potentially. That's my job. So some of these questions I'm going to give you are actually tools for finding your own answers. It wouldn't really be appropriate for me to tell you what you should answer, I think. But it might be appropriate for me to tell you what my answer is. However, I'm not even going to do that. As Krishnamurti would have us do, you're going to have to find the answers yourself. And by coming up with these some more questions, we may find better answers. Right? So let us consider chosen transformations, and then we'll think about unchosen ones that are thrust upon us. Here are a couple examples of transformations we often choose, or choose not to undertake. Becoming a parent in the time and manner of your own choosing. Seeking a new job when you already have one. It would be unchosen if you were fired, for instance, right? But we're talking about chosen ones now. Moving to a new town or even a new country. Marriage or long-term partnership and cohabitation. Becoming engaged in a community of choice. an elective surgery that would substantially change your body, taking a medication for mental illness. Now, some of these can be thrust upon us by fate, by the failure of our preparations, no matter how careful, contraception, by violence, by circumstance, right? But for now, we're just going to consider the chosen versions of these. Philosopher Lori Paul considers what she calls transformative experiences and suggests that many of them present what philosophers call epistemic challenges. I do teach, so I'm going to tell you what those words mean. Epistemology in philosophy is the study of knowledge. It includes what it is to say that we know something as opposed to just believing it. What is truth, capital T or little t, or however you want to see that. Who is seen as an authoritative knower and why some people have their testimony taken more seriously than others based on race or class or gender, etc. Why do we find some people more believable than others than for reasons that seem quite arbitrary? These are all epistemic questions in philosophy. And Lori Paul suggests there's a huge knowledge problem, an epistemic problem, with choosing to undergo a transformative experience. Namely, if it is truly transformative, we may be totally unable to know what we're getting into before it happens, right? We don't know what's on the other side of that choice. We may not be able to know how, whether, and to what degree we will be transformed. You could ask people, but as we're going to see, even that is problematic, right? Now, you may know enough about philosophy to know that philosophers love thought experiments. A thought experiment is a hypothetical scenario, sometimes quite bizarre, that aims to highlight the central problem the philosopher is considering. For instance, how do you know that right now you are not just a brain in a vat hooked up to a computer that's giving you sensory inputs? How do you know that you're really here? Right. In the classic example from Descartes, how do you know that there isn't a little devil on your shoulder deceiving you at every moment about the truth and reality, right? So philosophers like these because they allow you to sort of alter reality in such a way that you get to pay attention to what the philosopher making the experiment thinks is the most important thing about it, all right? So for Descartes, the biggest thing, his biggest problem was, how do I know anything is true and that I'm not being deceived? Right? How skeptical should I be about my experiences? So of course he picks the devil on your shoulder deceiving you, right? Because that makes sense at the time he lives. The brain in the vat hooked up to a computer thing would make no sense to him. That's clearly a modern example, right? Okay. So Lori Paul gives a thought experiment that's a little odd, and I needed to tell you about thought experiments so that when you hear this, you won't be like, that's so weird, I can't think about it, okay? So her thought experiment runs like this. This is from her 2014 book, Transformative Experience. And I find this really kind of engaging, and maybe you will too. It's sort of fun to think through. Let's pretend that modern day vampires don't drink the blood of humans. Okay. Already it's weird, right? They're vegetarian vampires, which means they only drink the blood of humanely farmed animals. You have a one-time only chance to become a modern-day vampire. You think, this is a pretty amazing opportunity. Do I want to gain immortality, amazing speed, strength, and power? But do I want to become undead, an immortal monster, and have to drink blood, however humanely farmed the source is? It's a tough call, you think. Then you go around asking people for their advice, and you discover that all of your friends and family members have already become vampires. They tell you, it is amazing. It is the best thing ever. It is absolutely fabulous. It's incredible. And they run out of superlatives, right? You get these new sensory capacities. You should definitely become a vampire. And then they say, then you say, can you tell me a little more about it? And they say, you have to become a vampire to know what it's like. You can't, as a mere human, understand what it's like to become a vampire just by hearing me talk about it. Until you're a vampire, you're just not going to know what it's going to be like. So they're telling you, you can't know what the choice entails, right? Okay, well, this is vampirism, so this is not very realistic for us, right? In this scenario, you neither know what you will become precisely, nor do you know whether the experience itself will make you into the kind of person who is convinced they made the right choice. In my experience, this is actually a startlingly good analogy for the choices I mentioned earlier, becoming a parent in the time and manner of your own choosing. You don't know necessarily what it's going to be like to parent. and you don't know if becoming a parent will make you into a person who will say, I was right to become a parent, and everyone else should too, right? Seeking a new job when you already have one, is there something about that process that turns you into a person who becomes committed to the fact that it was the right decision to do that? Right. Moving to a new town or even a new country, marriage or long-term partnership and cohabitation, becoming engaged in a community of choice, an elective surgery that would substantially change our bodies. Are these the kinds of experiences that would we not only can't know about ahead of time in terms of their full content, but where we could expect that they would probably turn us into the kind of people who would say we'd made the right decision? And then, how do we get our information about that if we can't sort of trust the judgments of people who've already undergone it because it has made them want to have undergone it? So in that sense, while the vampirism example is like totally weird, I grant that, right? It's also a kind of nice analogy that lets you step outside of your own transformative experiences and think about this one that's abstracted from reality. So some of these changes might be wonderful. Some might be terrible, these real life changes. But many cannot be understood in advance, perhaps. And some can change us so much that we come to be the kinds of people who cannot possibly regret that change. This is, I think, an aspect of transformations we don't think about enough, and it has implications both terrible and wonderful. Terrible because then we seem to not have the ability to make informed choices, right? And we might be making a choice that we ought to regret, but we come to be the kind of person where we don't. Wonderful because it means that we can adapt to almost anything, right? Almost anything. Let us for a moment consider the classic narrative of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. How many people have heard of this? Show of hands. Okay. Possibly many of you have seen this in films where they pick out different parts of the novel. So I'm going to give you an excerpt from the actual novel. Just as a refresher, Dr. Jekyll thought perhaps he had a cure that would help all mankind, that would be able to separate the good from the bad, highlight our angelic natures, and eliminate our less desirable natures, right? Out of frustration and virtue, he chose to test it on himself before anyone else. And while it was indeed successful in separating the good from the bad, it did not have the anticipated result. Indeed, the treatment altered him at a fundamental level, including in ways that made him think the alteration to be one that he did not wish to undo. So when Dr. Jekyll becomes Mr. Hyde is like, finally, I am my true self. Right. So here's a brief passage illustrating the transformation. This is kind of fun if you like science fiction stuff that's slightly horrific, but not super horrific. The most racking pangs succeeded, a grinding in the bones, deadly nausea, and a horror of the spirit that cannot be exceeded at the hour of birth or death. Then these agonies began swiftly to subside, and I came to myself as if out of a great sickness. There was something strange in my sensations, something indescribably sweet. I felt younger, lighter, happier in the body. Within, I was conscious of a heady recklessness, a current of disordered sensual images running like a mill race in my fancy, a solution of the bonds of obligation, an unknown but innocent freedom of the soul from morality, it turns out. I knew myself at the first breath of this new life to be more wicked, tenfold more wicked, sold a slave to my original evil, and the thought in that moment braced and delighted me like wine. All right. So here's a transformation that's fundamental. He didn't know what he was getting into ahead of time. And after it happens, the new him is like, yes, finally. I'm free from all the trappings of society. I'm Victorian society, right? And so this is really restrictive society. You could see how somebody might be like, finally, right? But it goes too far, right? What would it mean to undergo a transformation so extreme, to not know in advance for sure what we are choosing, and to suspect it possible that we would become a person who loved the transformation and insisted on maintaining it? What does this even do to the concept of choice and chosen transformations? We didn't go as far as vampirism or Jekyll and Hyde. Let's consider unchosen transformations, like maybe addiction. Right? We can choose other kinds of transformations, like education, or religious conversion, or the effective use of medications that alter mental illnesses. All of these are characterized to at least some degree by the fact that on the other side of the transformative experience, we become convinced the transformation is wondrous, correct, and enlightened. Even addiction for a time leads many people to feel wonderful, depending on what the thing in question is, right? With all of these, we may eventually come to doubt that the transformation was a good idea, but there is something about the transformation that will transform our ability to reflect on the transformation. It's like a totally philosophical thing to say. Use the same word like three times in a sentence, right? But you get the idea. How many people have an epiphany as a result of education? Now I see the interconnected nature of oppression in society, and then later wish to have it undone. Anyone? Maybe. But a lot of us think, oh, now we get it. Right. How many people discover the highs of heroin and cocaine and wish it undone? There's a reason that the psychology of addiction requires that the individual themselves be committed to the idea that they need to stop and that they need to hit rock bottom to do so. Is becoming a parent a similar situation? How about a religious conversion where you're unable to reflect legitimately on the transformation by its very nature? I just leave these thoughts to your mind. Like I said, more questions, no answers. Consider now more transformations, which indeed we did not choose. Some are part of the normal course of human life and the uncertain nature of the future. Others result from the fact that we cannot control the choices others can make, but that affect us. So, disease, aging, physical accidents, unplanned pregnancy or parenting, economic shifts as when jobs or careers disappear out from under us, family ostracism as a result of unchangeable features about us or the choices we make. These are major transformations when they happen to us, and they're things that we really don't have much say in choosing. But the very same difficulties with knowing, or epistemic difficulties, may apply to unchosen transformations. Even as they are happening to us, we cannot know what they will bring, and it might be good. Right? It might be fine, even if it's not good, right? So consider the so-called disability paradox. When asked to rate quality of life, very many people without significant disabilities say they are generally satisfied, with a majority saying they have excellent or good quality of life. Yet most people who are born with significant disabilities rate their satisfaction with life at the same level as people who are born without them. And after a period of adjustment, most people who acquire significant disabilities again report general satisfaction with their lives. Many will say, oh, I wish I hadn't been paralyzed from the waist down, but they'll still, if asked, like, do you enjoy your life? Is it good or excellent? Many of them will say yes. In fact, 54.3% of people with moderate to severe disabilities report having an excellent or good quality of life. And a large portion of the other folks with those disabilities report having a satisfactory quality of life, and they can live with, right? And yet studies show that if you ask persons without disabilities about what their lives would be like after a disability, they say it would be a low quality of life, right? So you ask able-bodied people, what would it be like if you became paralyzed? And they say, oh, it would be horrible. I could never have a good life after that. The tricky thing about this for philosophers, and for me as a medical ethicist, is that some then go on to characterize a life after disability as not worth living while they're able-bodied. And then they make judgments about refusing life-sustaining care on that basis. So there was a gentleman who was a hunter who was badly injured in a hunting accident last year and asked for life support to be turned off when he found out he was going to be paralyzed from the waist down, and he died. Yet the vast majority of people who have these kinds of significant disabilities, after a period of adjustment, come to rate their lives as at least satisfactory, and more than half of them as good or excellent quality of life. This is called the disability paradox. So becoming disabled is a transformative experience like the ones that Laurie Paul describes. It's straightforwardly unknowable in advance. And even if we can say, hey, folks who have disabilities, significant disabilities, are your lives pretty good by your judgment? And they say yes, we still can't know for sure if we'll be one of those people. Right. You can ask others, but you can't know for yourself. And our considered judgments about it are often incorrect, as evidenced by the fact that most able-bodied people say they could never live like that. While disability may come upon us not by choice, our choices to accept or refuse medical treatment are at least potentially within our own power, right? And this mix of chosen and unchosen, where you have unchosen circumstances and chosen responses, raises similar issues to those straightforwardly chosen things that Lori Paul was talking about. Do we become a vampire, right? Or do we have children? Do we take a new job? Do we move to a new place? Right? So when we become pregnant or a parent not by choice, when we become diseased, when we age, when we have a physical accident, when we experience economic shifts that lead our jobs or careers to disappear out from under us, all these are transformations whose characters we cannot know in advance. Our responses are all we control, but when we make those responses on the assumption that we can know the character of the transformations, we go badly wrong. So we've got to be pretty skeptical about this if we're going to be straightforwardly honest with ourselves, right? But there's another set of really useful concepts here that I'm not going to talk about nearly as much that might be helpful to you in your thinking. That's the notion of a positive good and a negative good, and that sounds odd, right? How could something be negatively good? Well, a positive good is when you seek out something that adds to your life. A negative good is when you seek out the absence of something that's bad. So a classic example of this is if you are trapped in a burning building and there is no way out, and you had the ability to end your life earlier than the fire would kill you, death would be a negative good because it would be the absence of burning to death. All right. And so this is a thing that's usually used with when talking about physician-assisted suicide for terminally ill patients, where death and earlier death is often seen as a negative good by the people who choose it. So a negative good or a positive good, when we seek out a transformative experience, is it to leave a terrible situation because anything must be better than this, that's a negative good. If we seek out a transformation and it's to find something even better that we want to actively have in our lives, that's a positive good. So many of us long for transformation not because of what it will bring, but because of what it will take us away from, pain and suffering, right? That's the negative good idea. So while I've spent far less time discussing these concepts than issues with radically transformative experiences, I suggest these two simple concepts of why we might seek transformation could really be very useful. So what does transformation mean to you? What transformations have you undergone? How sure are we, after a transformation which we find to have been good, that it is indeed good, as opposed to being a transformation that by its nature requires us to commit to it having been a good idea? Can we tell when a transformation brings peril or promise? Do they bring both? Is your own longing for particular transformations driven by a desire for transformation as a negative good, a longing to escape anything that may be better than this? Or is it driven by a desire for transformation as a positive good to acquire a particular kind of self? Only you can say, Guru. Only you can say. Right. Thanks. If I had my skirt, I could. Okay, great. And then maybe we could play it while everybody's exiting.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
So
while Allison quiets our chalice, our closing words are, our time together is finished, but our work is not done. May our spirits be renewed and our resolve strengthened as we meet the challenges of the week to come. This chalice flame is extinguished until we ignite it again with the spark of our communion. And our closing video is Divine Defying Gravity.
Something has changed within me. Something is not the same. I'm through with playing by the rules of someone else's game. To go back to sleep. It's time to trust my instincts. Close my eyes.
Coffee.